It would be nice to talk to her now. Lovely idea there. Next time I go on sabbatical, I'll take a woman in stasis. Get the best of both worlds. But he looked and felt like something washed from a flooded graveyard, unfit for polite company. Oh, well. He should not have let her board the long shot. Not for his own sake. He was glad enough that she had stayed over those 2 days. It had been like the story of Louis Wu and Paula Cherenkov, rewritten for a happy ending. Perhaps it had been better. Yet there was something shallow about Tila. It wasn't only her age. Louis's friends were of all ages, and some of the youngest were very deep indeed. Certainly they suffered most, as if hurting were part of the learning process, which it probably was. No, there was a lack of empathy in Tila, a lack of the ability to feel someone else's pain. Yet she could sense another's pleasure, and respond to pleasure, and create pleasure. She was a marvelous lover, painfully beautiful, almost new to the art, sensuous as a cat, and startlingly uninhibited. None of which would qualify her as an explorer. Tila's life had been happy and dull. Twice she had fallen in love, and twice she had been first to tire of the affair. She had never been in a bad stress situation, never been really hurt. When the time came, when Tila found her first genuine emergency, she would probably panic. "But I picked her as a lover," said Louis to himself. "Damn Nessus." If Tila had ever been found in a stress situation, Nessus would have rejected her as unlucky. It had been a mistake to bring her. She would be a liability. He would spend too much of his time protecting her when he should be protecting himself. What kinds of stress situations might they face? The puppeteers were good businessmen. They did not overpay. The long shot was a fee of unheard-of value. Louis had the chilly suspicion that they would earn it. "Sufficient unto the day," he said to himself. And he returned to his crash couch and slept for an hour under the sleep headset. Waking, he swung the ship into line and dropped back into the blind spot. 5.5 hours from Saul, he dropped out again. The puppeteer's coordinates defined a small rectangular section of the sky as seen from Saul, plus a radial distance in that direction. At that distance, those coordinates defined a cube half a light-year on a side. Somewhere in that volume, presumably, was a fleet of ships. Also in that volume, unless instruments had fouled him up, were Louis Wu and the Longshot. Somewhere far behind him was a bubble of stars, some 70 light-years in diameter. Known space was small and very far away. No point in searching for the fleet. Louis wouldn't know what to look for. He went to wake Nessus. Anchored by his teeth to an exercise rung, Nessus peered over Louis's shoulder. "I need certain stars for reference. Center that green-white giant and throw it on the scope screen." The pilot's cabin was crowded. Louis hunched over the instrument panel, protecting buttons from the puppeteer's careless hooves. "Spectroanalysis, yes. Now the blue and yellow double at 2 o'clock.
I have my bearings. Swing to 348.72.
"What exactly am I looking for, Nessus? A cluster of fusion flames? No, you'd be using thrusters."
"You must use the scope. When you see it, you will know."
On the scope screen was a sprinkling of anonymous stars. Louis ran the magnification up until... 5 dots in a regular pentagon, right?
"That is our destination."
"Good. Let me check the distance." "Tange, that's wrong, Nessus. They're too far away." No comment. "Well, they couldn't be ships, even if the distance meter isn't working. The puppeteer fleet must be moving at just under light speed. We'd see the motion." 5 dull stars in a regular pentagon. They were a fifth of a light-year distant, and quite invisible to the naked eye. At present scope magnification, they would have to be full-sized planets. In the scope screen, one was faintly less blue, faintly dimmer than the others. A Kepler rosette. How very odd. "Take 3 or more equal masses, set them at the points of an equilateral polygon, and give them equal angular velocities about their center of mass. Then the figure has stable equilibrium. The orbits of the masses may be circular or elliptical. Another mass may occupy the center of mass of the figure, or the center of mass may be empty. It doesn't matter. The figure is stable, like a pair of Trojan points. The difficulty is that there are several easy ways in which a mass can be captured by a Trojan point.
Consider the Trojan asteroids in Jupiter's orbit. But there is no easy way for five masses to fall accidentally into a Keplerer rosette.
That's wild, Louis murmured. Unique. Nobody's ever found a Keplerer rosette.
He let it trail off. Here between the stars, what could be lighting those objects?
Oh, no you don't, said Louis Wu. You'll never make me believe it. What kind of an idiot do you take me for?
What is it that you will not believe?
You know Tange well what I won't believe.
As you please. That is our destination, Louis. If you take us within range, a ship will be sent to match our velocity.
The rendezvous ship was a number 3 hull, a cylinder with round ends and a flattened belly, painted shocking pink and windowless. There were no engine apertures. The engines must be reactionless, thrusters of the human type or something more advanced. On Nessus's orders, Louis had let the other ship do the maneuvering. The long shot, on fusion drives alone, would have required months to match velocities with the puppeteer fleet. The puppeteer ship had done it in less than an hour, blinking into existence alongside the long shot with her access tube already reaching like a glass snake toward the long shot's airlock. Disembarking would be a problem. There wasn't room to release all the crew from stasis at once. More important, this would be Speaker's last chance to take control of the ship.
Do you think he will obey my task, Louis?
No, I think he'll risk one more shot at stealing the ship. Tell you what we'd better do.
They disconnected the instrument panel from the Longshot's fusion motors. It was nothing that the Kazin couldn't fix, given a little time and a touch of the mechanical intuition possessed by any toolmaker. But he would not have the time.
Louis watched the puppeteer move through the tube. Nessus was carrying Speaker's pressure suit. His eyes were tightly closed, which was a pity because the view was magnificent.
Free fall, said Teela when he opened her crash couch. I don't feel so good. Better guide me, Louis. What's happening? Are we there?
Louis told her a few details while he guided her to the airlock. She listened, but Louis guessed she was concentrating on the pit of her stomach. She looked acutely uncomfortable. There'll be gravity on the other ship, he told her. Her eyes found the tiny rosette where Louis pointed. It was a naked eye object now, a pentagon of 5 white stars. She turned with astounded questions in her eyes. The motion spun her semicircular canals, and Louis saw her expression change in the moment before she bolted into the airlock. Keplerer rosettes were one thing. Freefall sickness was something else again. Louis watched her recede against the unfamiliar stars. As the couch cover opened, Louis said, "Don't do anything startling. I'm armed." The Kazin's orange face did not change expression.
"Have we arrived?"
"Yeah, I've disconnected the fusion drive. You'd never reconnect it in time. We're in the sights of a pair of big ruby lasers."
"Suppose I were to escape in hyperdrive?" "No, my mistake. We must be within a singularity."
"You're in for a shock. We're in 5 singularities."
5? Really? But you lied about the lasers, Louis. Be ashamed."
At any rate, the Kazin left his couch peaceably enough. Louis followed with the variable sword at the ready. In the airlock, the Kazin stopped, suddenly caught by the sight of an expanding pentagon of stars. He could hardly have had a better view. The long shot, edging close in hyperdrive, had stopped half a light hour ahead of the puppeteer fleet, something less than the average distance between Earth and Jupiter. But the fleet was moving at terrible speed, falling just behind its own light, so that the light which reached the long shot came from much further away. When the long shot stopped, the rosette had been too small to see. It had been barely visible when Teela left the lock. Now it was impressively large and growing at enormous speed. 5 pale blue dots in a pentagon, spreading across the sky, growing, spreading. For a flashing instant, there were 5 worlds around the long shot. Then they were gone. Not fading, but gone. Their receding light reddened to invisibility. And Speaker to Animals held the variable sword.
"Finnegal's eyes!" Louis exploded. "Don't you have any curiosity at all?"
The Kazin considered.
"I have curiosity, but my pride is much stronger."
He retracted the wire blade and handed the variable sword back to Louis.
"A threat is a challenge. Shall we go?"
The puppeteer ship was a robot. Beyond the airlock, the life system was all one big room. Four crash couches, as varied in design as their intended occupants, faced each other in a circle around a refreshment console. There were no windows. There was gravity, to Louis's relief, but it was not quite Earth's gravity, nor was the air quite Earth's air. The pressure was a touch too high. There were smells, not unpleasant, but odd. Louis smelled ozone, hydrocarbons, puppeteer, dozens of puppeteers, and other smells he never expected to identify. There were no corners. The curved wall merged into floor and ceiling. The couches and the refreshment console all looked half-melted. In the puppeteer world, there would be nothing hard or sharp, nothing that could draw blood or raise a bruise. Nessus sprawled bonelessly in his couch. He looked ridiculously, ludicrously comfortable. "He won't talk," Teela laughed. "Of course not," said the puppeteer. "I would only have had to start over when you arrived. Doubtless you have been wondering about—"
"Flying worlds," the Kazin interrupted.
"And Kemplerer rosettes," said Louis. A barely audible hum told him that the ship was moving. He and Speaker stowed their luggage and joined the others in the couches. Teela handed Louis a red fruity drink and a squeeze bulb.
"How much time have we got?" he asked the puppeteer.
"An hour until we land. Then you will be briefed on our final destination."
"That should be long enough. Okay, speak to us. Why flying worlds? Somehow it doesn't seem safe to throw habitable worlds about with such gay abandon."
"Oh, but it is, Louis."
The puppeteer was terribly earnest.
"Much safer than this craft, for instance. And this craft is very safe compared to most human-designed craft. We have had much practice in the moving of worlds."
"Practice? How did that happen?"
"To explain this, I must speak of heat and of population control. You will not be embarrassed or offended?"
They signified negative. Louis had the grace not to laugh. Teela laughed.
"What you must know is that population control is very difficult for us. There are only two ways for one of us to avoid becoming a parent. One is major surgery. The other is total abstinence from sexual congress."
Teela was shocked.
"But that's terrible." "It is a handicap. Do not misunderstand me. Surgery is not a substitute for abstinence. It is to enforce abstinence. Today, such surgery can be reversed. In the past, it was impossible. Few of my species will willingly undergo such surgery."
Louis whistled.
"I should think so. So your population control depends on willpower."
"Yes. Abstinence has unpleasant side effects, with us as with most species. The result has traditionally been overpopulation. 500,000 years ago, we were 500,000,000,000 in human numbering. In Kazinti numbering—"
"My mathematics is good," said the Kazin. "But these problems do not seem to relate to the unusual nature of your fleet."
He was not complaining, merely commenting. From the refreshment console, Speaker had procured a double-handed flagon of Kazinti design and 0.5 gallons capacity.
"But it does relate, Speaker. 500,000,000,000 civilized beings produce a good deal of heat as a byproduct of their civilization."
"Were you civilized so long ago?"
"Certainly. What barbarian culture would support so large a population? We had long since run out of farming land and had been forced to terraform two worlds of our system for agriculture. For this, it was necessary to move them closer to our sun. You understand?"
"Your first experience in moving worlds. You used robot ships, of course."
"Of course. And after that, food was not a problem. Living space was not a problem. We built high even then, and we like each other's company."
"Herd instinct, I'll bet. Is that why this ship smells like a herd of puppeteers?"
"Yes, Louis. It is reassuring to us to smell the presence of our own kind. Our sole and only problem, at the time of which I speak, was heat."
"Heat?"
"Heat is produced as a waste product of civilization."
"I fail to understand," said Speaker to Animals.
Louis, who as a Flatlander understood perfectly, forbore to comment. Earth was far more crowded than Kazin.
"An example.
You would wish a light source at night, would you not, Speaker? Without a light source, you must sleep, whether or not you have better things to do.
This is elementary.
Assume that your light source is perfect. That is, it gives off radiation only in the spectra visible to Kazinti. Nonetheless, all light which does not escape through the window will be absorbed by walls and furniture. It will become randomized heat. Another example. Earth produces too little natural fresh water for its 18 billions. Salt water must be distilled through fusion. This produces heat. But our world, so much more crowded, would die in a day without the distilling plants. A third example. Transportation involving changes in velocity always produces heat. Spacecraft filled with grain from the agricultural worlds produce heat on re-entry and distribute it through our atmosphere. They produce more heat on takeoff.
But cooling systems?
Most kinds of cooling systems only pump heat around and produce more heat for power.
I begin to understand. The more puppeteers, the more heat is produced.
Do you understand, then, that the heat of our civilization was making our world uninhabitable?
Smog, thought Louis Wu. Internal combustion engines, fission bombs, and fusion rockets in the atmosphere. Industrial garbage in the lakes and oceans. It's often enough that we've half-killed ourselves in our own waste products. Without the fertility board, would the Earth be dying now in its own waste heat?
Incredible, said Speaker to animals. Why didn't you leave?
Who would trust his life to the many deaths of space? Only one such as me. Should we settle worlds with our insane?
Send cargoes of frozen fertilized ova. Run the ships with crews of the insane.
Discussions of sex make me uncomfortable. Our biology is not adapted to such methods, but doubtless we could evolve something analogous. But to what purpose? Our population would be the same, and our world would still have been dying of its own waste heat.
Irrelevantly, Teela said, I wish we could see out.
The puppeteer was astounded. Are you sure? Are you not subject to the fear of falling?
On a puppeteer ship?
Yes. In any case, our watching cannot increase the danger. Very well.
Nessus spoke musically in his own tongue, and the ship vanished. They could see themselves and each other. They could see four crash couches resting on emptiness, and the refreshment console in the middle. All else was black space. But five worlds glowed in white splendor behind Teela's dark hair. They were of equal size. Perhaps twice the angular diameter of the full moon is seen from the Earth. They formed a pentagram. Four of the worlds were circled by strings of tiny glaring lights, orbital suns giving off artificial yellow-white sunlight. These four were alike in brightness and appearance. Misty blue spheres, their continental outlines invisible at this distance. But the fifth world had no orbital lights. It glowed by its own light, in patches the shapes of continents and the colors of sunlight. Between the patches was a black that matched the black of surrounding space. And this black, too, was filled with stars. The black of space seemed to encroach on continents of sunlight.
I've never seen anything so beautiful, said Teela with tears in her voice.
And Louis, who had seen many things, was inclined to agree.
Incredible, said Speaker to animals. I hardly dared believe it. You took your worlds with you.
Puppeteers don't trust spacecraft, Louis said absently.
There was a touch of cold in the thought that he might have missed this, that the puppeteer might have chosen someone in his place. He might have died without seeing the puppeteer Rosette.
But how?
I had explained, said Nessus, that our civilization was dying in its own waste heat. Total conversion of energy had rid us of all waste products of civilization save that one. We had no choice but to move our world outward from its primary.
Was that not dangerous?
Very. There was much madness that year. For that reason, it is famous in our history. But we had purchased a reactionless, inertialess drive from the outsiders. You may guess their price. We are still paying in installments. We had moved two agricultural worlds. We had experimented with other useless worlds of our system using the outsider drive.
In any case, we did it. We moved our world. In later millennia, our numbers reached a full trillion. The dearth of natural sunlight made it necessary to light our streets during the day, producing more heat. Our sun was misbehaving. In short, we found that a sun was a liability rather than an asset. We moved our world to a tenth of a light-year's distance, keeping the primary only as an anchor. We needed the farming worlds, and it would have been dangerous to let our world wander randomly through space. Otherwise, we would not have needed a sun at all.
So, said Louis, that's why nobody ever found the puppeteer world.
That was part of the reason.
We searched every yellow dwarf sun in known space, and a number outside it. Wait a minute, Nessus. Somebody would have found the farming planets in a Kepler or Rosette.
Louis, they were searching the wrong suns.
What? You're obviously from a yellow dwarf.
We evolved under a yellow dwarf star, somewhat like Procyon. You may know that in 500,000 years Procyon will expand into the red giant stage.
Finnegal's heavy hand. Did your sun blow up into a red giant?
Yes. Shortly after we finished moving our world, our sun began the process of expansion. Your fathers were still using the upper thigh bone of an antelope to crack skulls. When you began to wonder where our world was, you were searching the wrong orbits about the wrong suns. We had brought suitable worlds from nearby systems, increasing our agricultural worlds to 4, and setting them in a Kepler or Rosette. It was necessary to move them all simultaneously when the sun began to expand, and to supply them with sources of ultraviolet to compensate for the reddened radiation. You will understand that when the time came to abandon Galaxy 200 years ago, we were well prepared. We had had practice in moving worlds.
The rosette of worlds had been expanding for some time. Now the puppeteer world glowed beneath their feet, rising to engulf them. Scattered stars in the black seas had expanded to become scores of small islands. The continents burned like sunfire. Long ago, Louis Wu had stood at the void edge of Mount Lookatthat. The Longfall River on that world ends in the tallest waterfall in known space. Louis's eyes had followed it down as far as they could penetrate the void mist. The featureless white of the void itself had grasped at his mind, and Louis Wu, half-hypnotized, had sworn to live forever. How else could he see all there was to see? Now he reaffirmed that decision, and the puppeteer world rose about him. "I am daunted," said Speaker to Animals. His naked pink tail lashed in agitation, though his furry face and burry voice carried no emotion. "Your lack of courage had deserved our contempt, Nessus, but our contempt has blinded us. Truly you are dangerous. Had you feared us enough, you would have ended our line. Your power is terrible. We could not have stopped you."
"Surely a Kazin cannot fear a herbivore."
Nessus had not spoken mockingly, but Speaker reacted with rage. "What sapient being would not fear such power?"
"You distress me. Fear is the brother of hate. One would expect a Kazin to attack what he fears."
The conversation was getting sticky. With the long shot millions of miles in their wake and known space hundreds of light-years away, they were all very much within the power of the puppeteers. If the puppeteers found reason to fear them... Change the subject fast. Louis opened his mouth.
"Hey," said Teela. "You people keep talking about Kepler rosettes. What's a Kepler rosette?"
And both aliens started to answer while Louis wondered why he had thought Teela shallow. Chapter 6. Christmas Ribbon. "The joke's on me," said Louis Wu. "Now I know where to find the puppeteer world. Very nice, Nessus. You kept your promise."
"I told you that you would find the information more surprising than useful."
"A good joke," said the Kazin. "Your sense of humor surprises me, Nessus."
Below, a tiny eel-shaped island surrounded by a black sea. The island rose like a fire salamander, and Louis thought he could pick out tall, slender buildings. Obviously, aliens would not be trusted on the mainland.
"We do not joke," said Nessus. "My species has no sense of humor."
"Strange. I would have thought that humor was an aspect of intelligence."
"No, humor is associated with an interrupted defense mechanism."
"All the same."
"Speaker,
No sapient being ever interrupts a defense mechanism.
As the ship dropped, the lights resolved. Sun panels along street levels, windows in buildings, light sources in park-like areas. In a last instant, Louis glimpsed buildings slender as rapier blades, miles tall. Then the city flashed up to engulf them, and they were down. Down in a parkland of colorful alien plants. Nobody moved. Puppeteers were the second most harmless-looking sentients in known space. They were too shy, too small, too weird to seem dangerous. They were merely funny. But suddenly Nessus was a member of his species, and his species was mightier than men had dreamed. The mad puppeteer sat quite still, his necks bobbing to observe his chosen underlings. There was nothing funny about Nessus. His race moved worlds, five at a time. So that Teela's giggle was a shocking sound.
"I was just thinking," she explained. "The only way to keep from having too many little puppeteers is no sex at all, right, Nessus?"
"Yes."
She giggled again.
"No wonder puppeteers don't have a sense of humor."
Through a park that was too regular, too symmetrical, too well-tamed, they followed a floating blue light. The air was thick with the spicy chemical smell of puppeteer. That smell was everywhere. It had been strong and artificial in the one-room life support system of the transfer ship. It had not diminished when the airlock opened. A trillion puppeteers had flavored the air of this world, and for all of eternity it would smell of puppeteer. Nessus danced. His small clawed hooves seemed barely to touch the resilient surface of the walk. The Kazin glided, cat-like, his naked pink tail whipping rhythmically back and forth. The sound of the puppeteer's walk was a tap dance in 3/4 time. From the Kazin came not the slightest whisper of motion. Teela's walk was almost as silent. Her walk always looked clumsy, but it wasn't. She never stumbled, never bumped anything. Louis, then, was the least graceful of the four. But why should Louis Wu be graceful? An altered ape, whom evolution had never entirely adapted to walking on flat ground. For millions of years his fathers had walked on all fours where they had to, had used the trees where they could. The Pliocene had ended that, with millions of years of drought. The forests had left Louis Wu's ancestors behind, high and dry and starving. In desperation, they had eaten meat. They had done better after learning the secret of the antelope's thigh bone, whose double-knobbed shoulder joint had left its mark in so many fossil skulls. Now, on feet still equipped with vestigial fingers, Louis Wu and Teela Brown walked with aliens. Aliens? They were all aliens here, even mad, exiled Nessus, with his brown and unkempt mane and his restless, searching heads. Speaker, too, was uneasy. His eyes, within their black spectacle markings, searched the alien vegetation for things with poison stings or razor teeth. Instinct, probably. Puppeteers would not permit dangerous beasts in their parks. They came upon a dome that glowed like a huge half-buried pearl. There the floating light split in two.
"I must leave you," said Nessus,
and Louis saw that the puppeteer was terrified.
"I go to confront those who lead."
He spoke low and urgently.
"Speaker, tell me quickly. Should I not return, would you seek me out to slay me for the insult I delivered in Krushenko's restaurant?"
"Is there risk that you will not return?"
"Some risk. Those who lead may dislike what I must tell them. I ask again, would you hunt me down?"
"Here, on an alien world, amid beings of such awesome power and such lack of faith in a Kazin's peaceful intent?"
The Kazin's tail lashed once, emphatically. "No, but neither would I continue with the expedition."
"That will be sufficient."
Nessus trotted off, trembling visibly, following the guide light.
"What's he scared of?" Teela complained. "He's done everything they told him to. Why would they be angry with him?"
"I think he's up to something," said Louis, "something devious. But what?"
The blue light moved on. They followed it into an iridescent hemisphere. Now the dome had vanished. From a triangle of couches, two humans and a Kazin looked out into a tame jungle of brilliant alien plants, watching the approach of a strange puppeteer. Either the dome itself was invisible from inside, or the park scene was a projection. The air smelled of many puppeteers.
The strange puppeteer pushed its way through a last fringe of hanging scarlet tendrils. Louis remembered when he had thought of Nessus as it. When had Nessus graduated to him? But Speaker, a familiar alien, had been him from the beginning. The puppeteer stopped there, just short of the presumed boundaries of the pearly dome. Its mane was silver, where Nessus's was brown, and was neatly coiffured in complex ringlets. But its voice was Nessus's thrilling contralto.
"I must apologize for not being present to greet you. You may address me as Chiron."
A projection, then. Louis and Teela murmured polite demurrers. Speaker to animals bared his teeth.
"The one you call Nessus knows all that you are about to learn. His presence was required elsewhere. However, he mentioned your reactions on learning of our engineering skills."
Louis winced. The puppeteer continued.
"This may be fortunate. You will understand the better when you learn of our own reactions to a more ambitious work of engineering."
Half the dome went black. Annoyingly, it was the side of the dome opposite to the projected puppeteer. Louis found a control to turn his couch, but he reflected that he would have needed two swiveled heads with independently operating eyes to watch both halves of the dome at once. The darkened side showed starry space forming a backdrop for a small, blazing disk. A ringed disk. The scene was a blow-up of the holo in Louis Wu's pocket. The light source was small and brilliant white, very like a view of Sol as seen from the general neighborhood of Jupiter. The ring was huge in diameter, wide enough to stretch half across the darkened side of the dome. But it was narrow, not much thicker than the light source at its axis. The near side was black, and where it cut across the light, sharp-edged. Its further side was a pale blue ribbon across space. If Louis was growing used to miracles, he was not yet so blasé as to make idiotic-sounding guesses. Instead, he said, "It looks like a star with a ring around it. What is it?" Chiron's reply came as no surprise.
"It is a star with a ring around it," said the puppeteer. "A ring of solid matter. An artifact."
Teela Brown clapped her hands and burst into giggles. She strangled the giggles after a few moments and managed to look wonderfully solemn. But her eyes glowed. Louis understood perfectly. He felt a touch of the same joy. The ringed sun was his and her private toy, a new thing in a mundane universe. "Take Christmas ribbon, pale blue and an inch wide, the kind you use to wrap presents. Set a lighted candle on a bare floor. Take 50 feet of ribbon and string it in a circle with the candle at the center, balancing the ribbon on edge so that the inner side catches the candlelight." But the Kazin's tail was lashing back and forth, back and forth. After all, that wasn't a candle in the middle, that was a sun.
"By now you know," said Chiron, "that we have been moving north along the galactic axis for the past 204 of your Earth years. In Kazin years..."
217.
"Yes. During that time, we have naturally observed the space ahead of us for signs of danger and the unexpected. We had known that the star EC-1752 was ringed with an uncharacteristically dense and narrow band of dark matter. It was assumed that the ring was dust or rock. Yet it was surprisingly regular. Some 90 days ago, our fleet of worlds reached a position such that the ring occluded the star itself. We saw that the ring was sharply bounded. Further investigation revealed that the ring is not gas, nor dust, nor even asteroidal rock, but a solid band of considerable tensile strength. Naturally, we were terrified."
Speaker to animals asked, "How were you able to deduce its tensile strength?"
"Spectroanalysis and frequency shifts gave us a relative difference in velocities. The ring is clearly rotating about its primary at 770 miles per second, a velocity high enough to compensate for the pull of gravity from the primary and to provide an additional centripetal acceleration of 9.94 meters per second. Consider the tensile strength needed to prevent the structure from disintegrating under such a pull."
"Gravity," said Louis.
"Apparently."
"Gravity,
a touch less than Earth's. There's somebody living there, on the inner surface.
Who? Said Louis Wu, for the full impact was beginning to hit him, and the little hairs were rising along his spinal column. He heard the swish-swish of the Kazin's tail cutting air. It was not the first time men had met their superiors. Thus far, men had been lucky.
Abruptly, Louis stood up and walked toward the dome wall. It didn't work. The ring and the star receded before him until he touched a smooth surface. But he saw something he hadn't noticed before. The ring was checkered. There were regular rectangular shadows along its blue back.
Can you give us a better picture?
We can expand it, said the contralto voice.
The G2 star jerked forward, then shot blazing off to the right, so that Louis was looking down on the lighted inner surface of the ring. Blurred as it was, Louis could only guess that the brighter, whiter areas might be cloud, that regions of faintly deeper blue might be land, where lighter blue was sea. But the shadowed areas were quite visible. The ring seemed to be laid out in rectangles, a long strip of glowing baby blue, followed by a shorter strip of deep navy blue, followed by another long strip of light blue. Dots and dashes.
Something's causing those shadows, he said. Something in orbit?
Yes, just that. 20 rectangular shapes orbit in a Kemplerer rosette much nearer the primary. We do not know their purpose.
You wouldn't. It's been too long since you had a sun. These orbiting rectangles must be there to separate night from day. Otherwise, it would always be high noon on the ring.
You will understand now why we called for your help. Your alien insights were bound to be of value.
Uh-huh. How big is the ring? Have you studied it much? Have you sent probes?
We have studied the ring as best we could without slowing our velocity and without otherwise attracting notice to ourselves. We have sent no probes, of course. Since they would have to be remotely controlled by hyperwave, such probes might be traced back to us.
You can't track a hyperwave signal. It's theoretically impossible.
Perhaps those who built the ring have evolved different theories. But we have studied the ring with other instruments.
As Chiron spoke, the scene on the dome wall changed to blacks and whites and grays. Outlines shifted and wavered.
We have taken photographs and holographs in all electromagnetic frequencies. If you are interested...
They don't show much detail.
No, the light is too much bent by gravitational fields and solar wind and intervening dust and gases. Our telescopes cannot find further detail.
So you haven't really learned much.
I would say that we have learned a great deal. One puzzling point. The ring apparently stops on the close order of 40% of neutrinos.
Tila merely looked bewildered, but Speaker made a startled sound, and Louis whistled, very low.
That eliminated everything.
Normal matter, even the terrifically compressed matter in the heart of a star, would stop almost no neutrinos. Any neutrino stood a 50-50 chance of getting through several light-years thickness of lead.
An object in a slaver stasis field reflected all neutrinos. So did a general product's hull. But nothing known would stop 40% of neutrinos and let the rest through.
Something new, then, said Louis. Chiron, how big is this ring? How massive is it?
The ring masses 2 × 10⁻³ power in grams, measures 0.95 × 10⁸ power miles in radius, and something less than 10⁶ power miles across.
Louis was not comfortable thinking in abstract powers of 10. He tried to translate the numbers into pictures. He had been right to think of inch-wide Christmas ribbon, balanced on edge and strung in a loop. The ring was more than 90 million miles in radius, about 600 million miles long, he estimated, but less than 1 million miles across, edge to edge. It massed a little more than the planet Jupiter.
Somehow that doesn't seem massive enough, he said. Something that big should weigh as much as a good-sized sun.
The Kazin agreed.
One has the ludicrous picture of billions of beings trying to live on a construct no thicker than book film.
Your intuition is wrong, said the puppeteer with silver curls. Consider the dimensions. If the ring were a ribbon of hull metal, for example, it would be approximately 50 feet thick.
50 feet? That was hard to believe. But Teela's eyes had been turned to the ceiling, and her lips had been moving silently but rapidly.
"He's right," she said. "The math works out. But what's it for? Why would anyone build such a thing?"
"Room."
"Room?"
"Room to live," Louis amplified. "That's what it's all about. 600 trillion square miles of surface area is 3 million times the surface area of the Earth. It'd be like having 3 million worlds all mapped flat and joined edge to edge. 3 million worlds within air car distance. That'd solve any population problem."
"And what a problem they must have had. You don't go into a project like that one just for kicks."
"A point," said the Kazin. "Chiron, have you searched neighboring stars for other similar rings?"
"Yes, we..."
"And found none, as I thought. If the race that built the ring had known of faster-than-light travel, they would have settled other stars. They would not have needed the ring. Therefore, there is only one ring."
"Yes."
"I am reassured. We are superior to the ringmakers in at least one respect."
The Kazin stood suddenly.
"Are we to explore the habitable surface of the ring?"
"A physical landing might prove to be overambitious."
"Nonsense. We must inspect the vehicle you have prepared for us. Is its landing gear sufficiently versatile? When may we depart?"
Chiron whistled, a startled burst of discord. "You must be mad. Consider the power of those who built this ring. They make my own civilization seem savages."
"Or cowards."
"Very well. You may go to inspect your craft when the one you call Nessus returns. For the time previous to that event, there are more data regarding the ring."
"You try my patience," said the speaker, but he sat down. "You liar," thought Louis. "You fake it well, and I'm proud of you." His own stomach was queasy as he returned to his couch. A baby blue ribbon stretched across the stars, and man had met superior beings again. The Kazinti had been first. When men first used fusion drives to cross the gaps between the stars, the Kazinti were already using the gravity polarizer to power their interstellar warships. It made their ships faster and more maneuverable than human ships. Man's resistance to the Kazinti fleet would have been nominal had it not been for the Kazinti lesson. A reaction drive is a weapon devastating in direct proportion to its efficiency as a drive. Their first foray into human space had been a terrific shock to the Kazinti. Human society had been peaceful for centuries, for so long that they had virtually forgotten war. But human interstellar ships used fusion-powered photon drives, launched by a combination of photon sail and asteroid-based laser cannon. So the Kazinti telepaths continued to report that the human worlds had no weapons at all, while giant laser cannon chopped at the Kazinti ships, and smaller mobile cannon darted in and out on the light pressure of their own beams. Slowed by unexpected human resistance and by the barrier of light speed, the war had run for decades instead of years, but the Kazinti would have won eventually. Except that an outsider ship had stumbled across the small human colony on We Made It. They had sold the mayor the secret of the outsider hyperdrive shunt on credit. We Made It had not known of the Kazinti War, but they learned of it fast enough when they had built a few faster-than-light ships. Against hyperdrive, the Kazinti hadn't a prayer. Later, the puppeteers had come to set up trading posts in human space. Man had been very lucky. 3 times he had met races technologically superior to him. The Kazinti would have crushed him without the outsider hyperdrive. The outsiders, again, were clearly his superiors, but they wanted nothing that man could give them, except supply bases and information, and these they could buy. In any case, the outsiders, fragile beings of helium-2 metabolism, were too vulnerable to heat and gravity to make good warriors. And the puppeteers, powerful beyond dreams, were too cowardly. Who had built the ring world? And were they warriors? Months later, Louis was to see Speaker's lie as his personal turning point. He might have backed out then, on Teela's behalf, of course.
The ring world was terrifying enough as an abstraction in numbers. To think of approaching it in a spacecraft, of landing on it. But Louis had seen the Kazin in terror of the puppeteer's flying worlds. Speaker's lie was a magnificent act of courage. Could Louis show himself a coward now? He sat down and turned to face the glowing projection, and as his eyes brushed Teela, he silently cursed her for an idiot. Her face was alive with wonder and delight. She was as eager as the Kazin pretended to be. Was she too stupid to be afraid? There was an atmosphere on the ring's inner side. Spectroanalysis showed the air to be as thick as Earth's, and of approximately the same composition. Definitely breathable to man and Kazin and puppeteer. What kept it from blowing away was a thing to be guessed at. They would have to go and look. In the system of the G2 sun, there was nothing at all but the ring itself. No planets, no asteroids, no comets. "They cleaned it out," said Louis. "They didn't want anything to hit the ring."
"Naturally," said the puppeteer with silver curls. "If something did strike the ring, it would strike at a minimum of 770 miles per second, the speed of rotation of the ring itself. No matter how strong the material of the ring, there would always be the danger of an object missing the outer surface and crossing the sun to strike the unprotected, inhabited inner surface."
The sun itself was a yellow dwarf, somewhat cooler than Sol and a touch smaller. "We will need heat suits on the ring," said the Kazin, rubbing it in, Louis thought.
"No," said Chiron. "The temperature of the inner surface is quite tolerable to all of our species."
"How would you know that?"
"The frequency of the infrared radiation emitted by the outer surface."
"You see me exposed as a fool."
"Not at all. We have been studying the ring since its discovery, while you have had a few eighths of minutes. The infrared frequency indicates an average temperature of 290 degrees absolute, which of course applies to the inner as well as the outer surface of the ring. For you, this will be some 10 degrees warmer than optimum, speaker to animals. For Louis and Teela, it is optimum. Do not let our attention to details mislead or frighten you, Chiron added. We would not permit a landing unless the ring engineers themselves insisted. We merely wish you to be ready for any eventuality.
You don't have any detail of surface formations?
Unfortunately, no. The resolving power of our instruments is insufficient.
We can do some guessing, said Teela. The 30-hour day-night cycle, for instance. Their original world must have turned that fast. Do you suppose that's their original system?
We assume that it is, since they apparently did not have hyperdrive, said Chiron. But presumably they could have moved their world to another system, using their own techniques.
And should have, the Kazin rumbled, rather than destroy their own system in the course of building their ring. I think we will find their own system somewhere nearby, as denuded of worlds as this one. They would have used terraforming techniques to settle all of the worlds of their own system before adapting this more desperate expedient.
Teela said, desperate.
Then, when they had finished building their ring around the sun, they would have been forced to move all their worlds into this system to transfer their populations.
Maybe not, said Louis. They might have used big STL ships to settle their ring if it was close enough to their own system.
Why desperate?
They looked at her.
I would have thought they built the ring for...
Teela floundered.
Because they wanted to.
For kicks? For scenery? Finnegal's fist! Teela, think of the resources they'd have to divert. Remember, they must have had a hell of a population problem. By the time they needed the ring for living room, they probably couldn't afford to build it. They built it anyway because they needed it.
Hmm, said Teela, looking puzzled. Nessus returns, said Chiron.
Without another word, the puppeteer turned and trotted away into the park. Chapter 7. Stepping Discs.
That was rude, said Teela.
Chiron doesn't want to meet Nessus, didn't I tell you? They think Nessus is crazy.
They're all crazy.
Well, they don't think so, but that doesn't make you wrong. Still want to go?
Teela's answer was the same uncomprehending look she'd given him when he tried to explain Whiplash of the Heart.
You still want to go?
Louis confirmed sadly.
Sure, who wouldn't? What are the puppeteers afraid of?
I understand that, said Speaker to Animals. The puppeteers are cowards, but I fail to see why they insist on knowing more than they do. Louis, they have already passed the ringed sun, traveling at nearly light speed. Those who built the ring assuredly did not have faster-than-light travel. Thus they can be no danger to the puppeteers, now or ever. I fail to understand our role in this matter.
It figures.
Must I take that as an insult?
No, of course not. It's just that we keep running up against population problems. Why should you understand?
Quite so. Explain, if you please.
Louis had been scanning the tame jungle for a glimpse of Nessus. Nessus could probably tell this better. Too bad. Okay, imagine a trillion puppeteers on this world. Can you do it?
I can smell them individually. The very concept makes me itch.
Now, imagine them on the ring world. Better, yes?
Yes. With more than 8^7 power times as much room. But still I fail to understand. Do you suppose the puppeteers plan conquest? But how would they transfer themselves to the ring afterward? They do not trust spacecraft.
I don't know. They don't make war, either. That's not the point. The point is the ring world safe to live on? You see? Maybe they're thinking of building their own ring worlds. Maybe they expect to find an empty one out there in the clouds of Magellan. Not an unreasonable hope, by the way. But it doesn't matter. They have to know if it's safe before they do anything. Here comes Nessus. Teela stood up and moved to the invisible wall. He looks drunk. Do puppeteers get drunk? Nessus wasn't trotting. He came tippy-toe, circling a 4-foot chrome-yellow feather with exaggerated wariness, moving 1 foot at a time, while his flat head darted this way and that. He had almost reached the lecture dome when something like a large black butterfly settled on his rump. Nessus screamed like a woman, leapt forward as if clearing a high fence. He landed rolling. When he stopped rolling, he remained curled into a ball, with his back arched and his legs folded, and his heads and necks tucked between his forelegs. Louis was running. "Depressive cycle!" he shouted over his shoulder. By luck and memory, he found the entrance in the invisible dome. He darted out into the park. All the flowers smelled like puppeteer. If all the life of the puppeteer world had the same chemical basis, how could Nessus take nourishment from warm carrot juice? Louis followed a right-angle zigzag of manicured dusty orange hedge and came upon the puppeteer. He knelt beside him. "It's Louis," he said. "You're safe." He reached gently into the tangled mop over the puppeteer's skull and scratched gently. The puppeteer jerked at the touch, then settled down. This was a bad one. No need to make the puppeteer face the world just yet. Louis asked, "Was that thing dangerous, the one that landed on you?"
"That? No."
The contralto voice was muffled, but beautifully pure and without inflection.
"It was only a flower sniffer."
"How did it go with those who lead?" Nessus winced.
"I won."
"Fine. What did you win?"
"My right to breed, and a set of mates."
"Is that what has you so scared?"
It wasn't unlikely, Louis thought. Nessus could be the counterpart to a male black widow spider, doomed by love. Then again, he might be a nervous virgin, of either sex or of any sex.
The puppeteer said, "I might have failed, Louis. I faced them down. I bluffed them."
"Go on."
Louis was aware that Teela and Speaker to Animals had joined them. He continued scratching gently in Nessus's mane. Nessus had not moved. The muffled, inflectionless contralto voice said,
"Those who lead offered me the legal right to reproduce my kind if I survived the voyage we must make. But this was not enough. To become a parent I need mates. Who will willingly mate with a straggly-maned maniac? It was necessary to bluff. Find me a mate, I told them, or I will withdraw from the voyage. If I withdraw, so will the Kazin," I said. They were enraged.
"I can believe that. You must have been in the manic state."
"I worked myself up to it. I threatened them with ruin to their plans, and they capitulated. Some selfless volunteer," I said, "must agree to mate with me if I return from the ring."
"Beautiful. Nice going. Did you get volunteers?"
one of our sexes is property, non-sentient, stupid. I needed only one volunteer. Those who lead...
Teela broke in.
Why don't you just say leaders?
I had tried to translate into your terms, said the puppeteer. A more accurate translation of the term would be those who lead from behind. There is a selected chairman, or speaker for all, or... The accurate translation of his title is hindmost. It was the hindmost who accepted me as his mate. He said that he would not ask another to so sacrifice his self-respect.
Louis whistled. That's something. Go ahead and cringe, you deserve it. Better to be scared now that it's all over.
Nessus stirred, relaxing somewhat.
That pronoun, said Louis, it bugs me. Either I should be calling you she, or I should be calling the hindmost she.
This is indelicate of you, Louis. One does not discuss sex with an alien race.
A head emerged from between Nessus's legs and focused, disapproving.
You and Teela would not mate in my sight, would you?
Oddly enough, the subject did come up once, and Teela said,
I'm offended, the puppeteer stated.
Why? Asked Teela.
The puppeteer's exposed head dived for cover.
Oh, come out of there. I won't hurt you.
Truly?
Truly. I mean honest. I think you're cute.
The puppeteer unrolled completely.
Did I hear you call me cute?
Yeah.
She looked up at the orange wall of speaker to animals and...
You too,
she said generously.
I do not mean to give offense, said the Kazin, but do not ever say that again. Ever.
Teela looked puzzled. There was a dusty orange hedge, 10 feet tall and perfectly straight, equipped with cobalt-blue tentacles that hung limp. From the look of them, the hedge had once been carnivorous. It was the border to the park, and Nessus led his little group toward it. Louis was expecting a gap in the hedge. He was unprepared when Nessus walked straight into it. The hedge parted for the puppeteer and closed after him. They followed. They walked out from under a sky-blue sky, but when the hedge had closed after them, the sky was black and white. Against the black sky of perpetual night, drifting clouds blazed white in the light cast upon their underbellies by miles of city. For the city was there, looming over them. At first glance, it differed from earthly cities only in degree. The buildings were thicker, blockier, more uniform, and they were higher, terribly high, so that the sky was all lighted windows and lighted balconies with straight hairline cracks of darkness marking the zenith. Here were the right angles denied to puppeteer furniture. Here on the buildings, where a right angle was far too big to bash a careless knee. But why had the city not loomed similarly over the park? On Earth, there were few buildings more than a mile high. Here, none were less. Louis guessed at light-bending fields around the park's borders. He never got around to asking. It was the least of the miracles of the puppeteer world.
Our vehicle is at the other end of the island, said Nessus. We can be there in a minute or less, using the stepping disks. I will show you.
You feel all right now?
Yes, Teela. As Louis says, the worst is over.
The puppeteer pranced lightly ahead of them.
The hindmost is my love. I need only return from the ring world.
The path was soft. To the eye it was concrete set with iridescent particles, but to the feet it was damp, spongy soil. Presently, after walking a very long block, they came to an intersection.
We must go this way, said Nessus, nodding ahead of him. Do not step on the first disk. Follow me.
At the center of the intersection was a large blue rectangle. 4 blue disks surrounded the rectangle, one at the mouth of each walk.
You may step on the rectangle if you wish, said Nessus, but not on inappropriate disks. Follow me.
He circled the nearest disk, crossed the intersection, trotted onto the disk on the opposite side, and vanished. For a stunned moment, nobody moved. Then Teela yelled like a banshee and ran at the disk, and was gone. Speaker to animals snarled and leapt. No tiger could have aimed as accurately. Then Louis was alone.
By the mist demons, he said wonderingly. They've got open transfer booths.
And he walked forward. He was standing on a square at the center of the next intersection, between Nessus and Speaker.
Your mate ran ahead, said Nessus. I hope she will wait for us.
The puppeteer walked off the rectangle in the direction he was facing.